This is Anne Conacher from the Scottish Public Health Network. So I'd like to welcome you and Ben Peeler to this SMASH virtual event. By my tally, we think we've got about 15 people online, so I think we'll just make a start. I'll introduce Ben in a moment, but I just wanted to make sure that everybody had the slides that Ben had sent over to us earlier in the week.
Sorry, it's Dermot Cormor speaking. I don't actually have the slides in front of me. Who had sent them to me? Was it Ryan Hughes?
Ben the calendar. Yeah, so Ben the calendar.
Do you have the calendar invite, Dermot?
Yes.
They're embedded within the calendar invite?
Yes, got it, thank you.
You got them?
Yeah.
Hi, for whoever just joined, I was just checking that everybody had the slides.
Yes, I've got the slides, thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Yep.
Because we've got a few people on the line, I'd asked for questions to Ben that you have with regards to his presentation to be emailed to me or texted to me, so I hope you have my contact details. This is Anne Conacher for the person that just joined. Okay. I'll assume from silence that everybody has those contact details. So what I'm going to ask is that Ben does his presentation and that we keep questions for the end, but please feel free to email or text those in as you're listening to the presentation, and then I'll pose them to Ben at the end of our time together. Ben, thank you very much for doing this presentation. Ben's a senior research fellow from the European Centre of Environment and Human Health at Exeter University. He's got an interest in environmental health interconnections, health geographies and socioeconomic health inequalities. And he'll be presenting today on natural environments and health and well-being. And I'm sure we'll go into more detail about his work throughout the course of the presentation. So, Ben, can I... Yes, I meant to say, Ben has very helpfully numbered all the slides. So if there's any particular slide that you want to refer to in your question, you could perhaps refer to that slide number. Okay. So without further ado, Ben, can I hand over to you, please?
And thanks very much for having me present to the group. I really appreciate the opportunity. And like Anne says, I'm really happy to take any questions at the end, and I can share contact details as well for follow-up. So just so you know sort of where I'm coming from, we're the European Centre for Environment and Human Health, a research centre of the Exeter Medical School, actually based down here in Truro in the west of Cornwall. And we do a real wide range of research on lots of different aspects of the environment and public health and how they connect, from antibiotic resistance in the environment through to global climate change impacts on population health. And one of the key strands of our research is this whole area around natural environments, perhaps often referred to as green space or green and blue space, and how it impacts on health and well-being. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. And I'll try and let you know when I'm skipping slides and stuff so that you can keep up. And like Anne says, hopefully most of them have got a number in the top left corner, so I'll try and remember to refer to that. But if you do get lost, or if I've got carried away and forgotten to let you know, then do just pipe up and let me know, and I can make sure everybody knows what we're supposed to be looking at. So without further ado, on my outline slide, slide two, I'm going to talk a bit about the pathways from nature to health and well-being. I'm going to discuss a bit about some of the recent evidence we've got around green space and blue space, and also how it links with work on health inequalities. And I'll finish up with some of the sort of implications of this kind of research, particularly on how we value nature for health and how we use our evidence in sort of hopefully underpinning and supporting policy and practice. So slide three. This is a sort of a modified version of a pathway that came originally from a 2014 publication by Terry Hartig and colleagues around what we might expect to be the sort of mechanism linking natural environments and health and well-being.
for whoever just joined us, we're up to slide 3 just now. And so it starts on the left with the natural environment, kind of what's out there in terms of its the type of environment, its quality and quantity, however we measure it. So the environment is out there. We then have modes by which we contact that nature, whether it's through a window or through going for a run in it or going for a walk, or all the different ways in which we can actually sort of engage with those different types of natural environments. And then we have a whole load of possible salutogenic mechanisms, that, so ways in which those natural environments might actually promote health and well-being. And they range from the sort of more obvious things like physical activity and psychological mechanisms, through to things like how biodiversity, microbe biodiversity in our natural environments might actually relate to human microbe biodiversity and how that might impact on our health and well-being. And new sorts of mechanisms are being listed all the time. And then via those mechanisms, we have potentially higher likelihoods of good health and well-being outcomes, and perhaps lower likelihoods of bad health outcomes like morbidity and mortality. And of course, that's a very simplistic, linear way to treat the world, and we know that it's going to be dependent on the context that we find ourselves in, perhaps urban, rural areas, and confounding and effect modification by socioeconomic status, gender, age, and so on. So as the typical kind of complex mixture of stuff through this kind of pathway between natural environments and health and well-being. And if we go on to slide 4, that just adds in even more complexity there, thinking about, well, okay, that's kind of fine as a framework, but actually we know that there's going to be a lot of other stuff impacting this as well, like societal structures we find ourselves in, what's kind of normal in our local culture. We know that's potentially really important with how people actually engage with the environment, how connected we are to nature, and that might well get determined fairly early on in life, you know, when we're kids and how much time we spend outdoors, and our own individual agency, just sort of our individual capacity to capitalise on, to use those natural environments, to spend time in them. So it's a complex picture. That's kind of part of the course, really, I guess, in most public health. So moving on to slide 5, how do we actually understand this complexity? Well, certainly here in the Centre, we take a very broad approach to how we do research. It covers all these different types of approaches, and there's a general kind of acceptance, I think, as is the case really with lots of public health, that, you know, doing a traditional randomised controlled trial is not often going to be an option that's open to us. Randomising people to live near to nature or far from nature for 10, 15 years, it's not going to happen. So we have to take this broad range of different types of studies to really sort of develop our evidence base to try and understand those complex relationships further. So we'll skip over slide 6, which has a nice picture of the Lake District, and on to slide 7, where I'm going to talk a bit about some green space mental health and wellbeing research that we've done relatively recently here in the Centre. So slide 8 has got a lot of text on it, and I'll just work through it briefly. In this study, we were looking at urban green space and mental health in England, using data from the British Household Panel Survey. And the nice thing about this data is it followed about 5,000 households over about 18 years from 1991. So this was a real opportunity to do one of the first pieces of longitudinal research on the relationship between green space and mental health. Prior to this, much of the research that had been done was cross-sectional, which is obviously valuable, but comes with lots of limitations. So we're really lucky to be able to link the BHPS data to green space data, and particularly to look at two particular health outcomes. So the GHQ-12, which some of you might be familiar with, a sort of a measure of mental distress, really, often used as an anxiety, depression screening tool. And also subjective well-being, a life satisfaction question, which is very similar to one of the ONS4 subjective well-being questions that are now used in the sort of national well-being accounts. So we have these two sort of opposite sides of mental health and well-being, I suppose, but that R figure at the bottom, -0.5, suggests these things are inversely correlated with each other. So if you're scoring higher on the GHQ questions, you're potentially more likely to score lower on the life satisfaction questions, but they don't completely correlate, so they are capturing slightly different aspects, even though they are sort of the opposite sides of the coin. So we've got this data, if we go on to slide 9, from the British Household Panel Survey for all of those participants that took part, and there are those questions every year from 1991 through to 2008. And we can link our environmental data, so our sort of land use data, in this case is a relatively simplistic view of the environment just around green space. So we know which small area the participants lived in each of these years, and we know their self-reported mental health and well-being, and then we link that geographically with environmental data as we go along through every year. If somebody just joined us, we're on up to slide 9.
Hello, Kelly, sorry.
No worries. So we're on slide 9 of the presentation. And the question we're asking with this study really is, do people report better mental health in years when they live in greener urban areas? And the nice thing about this study is because it's longitudinal, we're asking this question about within individual change. So it's about looking at, for an individual person, in the years when they lived in a greener environment, did they tend to report better mental health? So it's quite a nice, robust study design. And if you flip on to slide 10, the answer to that question is yes. So after adjusting for all of these individual level things that we know might be involved in this as confounding factors, so things like age and income and education and so on, we're able to demonstrate that indeed over those 18 years, when people lived in greener urban areas, they tended to report better mental health, both better scores on the GHQ-12 plus better scores on the life satisfaction question. And to put that in context, if we go on to slide 11, one of the nice things about this kind of analysis is that we can say, so what? So what is this kind of effect or this association with green space? How does it figure in to all the other things that we know are really important in determining mental health and well-being? And so just looking at the left-hand graph on the GHQ questions, we've got the estimated kind of positive impact on GHQ scores of living in high versus low green space. So quite a substantial change in green space here, so going from below one standard deviation below the mean to one standard deviation above the mean in terms of green kind of neighbourhood. But for that relatively sort of substantial change in green space, we get a positive effect. And that positive effect we find is about a tenth of the positive effect of having a job versus being unemployed, and we obviously know that's really important in relating to mental health and well-being. And it's about a third of the effect of the positive effects of being married versus being single, which is a well-established thing using these kinds of data. So we can see it in context. We can see it's a relatively small association in terms of its strength, but actually potentially still quite important given how widespread this exposure could be for the whole population. So if we move on to the next slide, I'm going to talk a bit about blue space. A lot of the research that we do here in the centre has looked at coastal environments particularly, but also inland blue environments. And this is part of our attempt to start to unpick our natural environments a bit more. A lot of the research, certainly until relatively recently, just lumped everything together and called it green space, whatever it was, just for sort of non-built environment. But we've followed up quite a lot of different research around blue space, and just to give you a brief example, let's move on to slide 13. It's a really important environment for us, certainly in the UK, but more broadly in Europe. We've got nearly 90,000 kilometres of coastline just in Europe. About 200 million people live there, 5.5 million jobs. It generates a massive amount of economic activity. And most of our sort of population are living in urban environments on the coast. This isn't about nice, pretty Cornish fishing villages like the one that I just showed you a picture of. And the Rhone Declaration from 2014 found that many people have little understanding of the importance of our seas and oceans in their daily lives and the impact they have on human health and well-being. So that's something that we've been involved in and trying to do something about. So if we go on to slide 14, just to describe one of the sort of first bits of large-scale research that we did on this area, I've got a map here of England, and I apologise for leaving out Scotland and Wales and the rest of the UK from this. This is all to do with how we collect our census data and other kinds of data that we use for this. It just meant it makes things complex sometimes to use data for the whole of the UK. So this is just an England study, and we have here a very typical map of the health geography of England. Based on census data, it's nice, we've got 48 million people on this map, distributed across around 30,000 small areas. And fundamentally what the map is showing us is that the darker blue areas are our less healthy areas in the places that we know we'd expect to find that, in the post-industrial areas of the Midlands and the North, particularly the eastern end of London, and actually progressively as you come southwest down to us here in Cornwall, with our post-mining and post-fishing kind of environments. So very typical health geography for England, and obviously lots and lots of determinants of that geography. But the one we're interested in, if we go on to the next slide, is how far away are those areas from the coast? This is a slightly pointless map, really. It just shows you that the dark blue areas are close to the coast and the light blue areas are far away from the coast. But we're able to link these data sets together. And if we skip on to the next slide, we can have a look at what this geography looks like. And actually what's really interesting is if you just plot the average kind of percentage of the population with good or very good health, so looking at a positive health measure here, in terms of how far away they are from the coast, actually what we see is that our coastal communities are less healthy than our more inland communities, and that's what this graph is showing. But this is obviously a very crude measure, and we know that our health geography is determined by lots of other things as well. So actually, if we go to the next slide, it's not very helpful because this graph is the other way around, but what this graph is showing is after we've accounted for, just fairly simply, for population age, sex, indices of deprivation, and also neighbourhood green space, that relationship flips. And so what that's telling us is that those coastal communities, and here we're focusing on urban coastal communities across England, those urban coastal communities are the population for better health than we would expect, given how socioeconomically deprived and how much older they are on the whole as those populations. So there's a really interesting finding there. We go from a sort of negative image of health on the coast, and we know our coastal communities are among some of the sort of older communities and also socioeconomically deprived, but actually they are healthier than inland communities once we take into account those kind of compounding factors. So it gives us, you know, an interesting bit of context, and obviously it's a very broad ecological cross-sectional study with all the kind of epidemiology caveats that would come with that kind of study. But it gave us a really good context to then go on, and we've done lots of other research since then, picking apart those mechanisms and looking at some of the other sort of aspects of health at the coast and how coastal environments particularly might be related to our different kinds of health and wellbeing outcomes. If we skip on to slide 18, I just wanted to mention briefly here about how good quality environments might have the potential to mitigate socioeconomic health inequalities. Potentially, that possibility that being in a good quality physical environment could potentially lend some degree of resilience to the adverse health impacts of poverty and low socioeconomic status. And Rich Mitchell at Glasgow and colleagues have coined this term equigenesis, or it was a word that was around already, but they coined it in relation to this area and thinking about, well, if these good quality environments, in this case, sort of natural environments, green space and blue space, are they equality promoting? Do they tend to kind of, to some extent, mitigate those kind of health inequalities? And so they've done some really nice work on that, and we've done a little bit too. So if we go on to slide 19, looking at health at the coast and equigenesis, if we divide up our census population into five quintiles, so on the left, our most deprived 20% of urban England, and on the right, our least deprived 20% of urban England, we can see that that relationship holds, but actually it holds most strongly for the most deprived neighbourhoods. And this would fit with work that Rich Mitchell and co have done on mortality in green space, and this has been done in other places as well with other data sets. And the suggestion here is that we find this relationship between living near the coast and positive health in our more deprived neighbourhoods, and we really don't see it at all in our less deprived neighbourhoods. And there's lots of speculation we could make. Really, we don't understand this fully, but we can imagine that one of the key things might be that with lower mobility and more kind of time spent in the home neighbourhood environment and less capacity to get out of it, perhaps our neighbourhood environments are more important for folks who live in more deprived kinds of neighbourhoods. But it's a really interesting discussion point, and it's something that we sort of are doing more work on, and I think it needs lots more tea in the past. But we do find this relatively consistently in different kinds of analyses. That's an interesting aspect. If we skip on to slide 20, I'm going to talk a bit now. We've covered so far just neighbourhood environments, so thinking about residential neighbourhood as an indicator of somebody's environmental exposure, how much green space is there in their neighbourhood, how far from the coast do they live, those kinds of things. We really want to get into this a bit more, and so think about what about actual visits to nature? Can we understand something about what it means to take a visit to a natural environment and what that might do for our health and well-being? So if we go on to slide 21, we're really fortunate here having the MENI, the Monitor of Engagement of the Natural Environment, a Natural England survey that's been running for quite a long time now. I think we're up to about year 8. There's a similar survey in Scotland called SPAND, and a similar one in Wales as well that we've been doing a bit of work on recently. But a lot of our work has been with the MENI. And this is really nice because it's an in-home face-to-face survey that's quite robust. It's repeat cross-sectional with about 50,000 people a year taking part. So it's a really big survey, and it's basically trying to understand how the people engage with natural environments. What do they do there? Who do they go with? Lots of sort of usual socio-demographic questions about them. And we can see things like the estimate is about 1.5 billion visits to nature involve going for a walk with a dog, but perhaps about 800 million walking without a dog, but lots of other things that people do out and about as well, playing with kids and eating and drinking out and so on. And they visit lots of different types of environments. And this includes everything from, and we can see in the infographic there, over 40% of these visits are within towns and cities. So lots of these visits people report are to our urban parks, allotments, perhaps churchyards, other kinds of natural environments within urban environments. So it's a really nice data set for us to work with, and it also asks questions around people's health and well-being, so we've done quite a bit of work looking at that. So slide 22, a subset of the folks in this survey are asked about their experiences. So they're asked about a visit they took to nature last week, and if they did take one, which is about 40% of the sample. And there are lots of questions about that visit in specific. And there are this kind of stress reduction set of questions where we can assess at least to what extent they self-report feeling these kinds of perhaps stress recovery type characteristics after their visit. And it's nice individual level survey data, so we get to control for lots of individual level confounders, what they were doing, who they were with, and so on. So slide 23, fairly sort of relatively simple analysis of this data, but basically demonstrating that everybody reports some degree of stress reduction by their visit to natural environments. This is a 0 to 5 scale, so everybody's reporting some sort of positive impact. But we can see that these environments are not equal, and there's definitely some differentials. So our urban green spaces are definitely doing something positive, but perhaps less so in some of our sort of woodland and mountain environments, particularly and coastal and beach environments, coming up pretty positive as well. So some sort of interesting findings that, again, suggesting that all green space is not equal, and the way that we think about our environment that we inhabit needs to be a bit more sophisticated than just calling it built or green space. And if we go on, that survey also asks the question about physical activity, and I won't read it out, but you can see it's a fairly typical kind of self-reported physical activity question to try and get at least what used to be the government guidelines for 150 minutes or more a week of moderate to vigorous physical activity. And so this question is asked of people, so we're able to look at a question in this case, specifically looking at coastal environments, to see whether people who live in and visit coastal environments maybe report better or more physical activity. So on to slide 25, we posed the question, do people who live near the coast exercise more? And the answer seems to be yes. So a small but significant odds ratio for coastal inhabitants versus inland inhabitants. And our inland inhabitants here are those just living more than 20 kilometres away from the coast. So what we in other places might be considered a coastal environment, actually here in the UK, you know, we have this, everybody lives relatively close to the coast. So there does seem to be this positive relationship. And actually what was really interesting with this study is when we broke it down by region, we looked across the six key sort of regions that have a coast in England, and we found this relationship really only strongly in the southwest and the northwest. And when we looked at the eastern and southeastern coasts of England, we didn't find this relationship at all. And that was really interesting for us, and again, something that we haven't really delved into yet. It might be something about the sort of physical characteristics of those coastal environments, but it might go back to my sort of pathways diagram, something about cultural norms or what is the sort of societal structures and what's going on for the population living in those places, where we definitely see this association between the coast and physical activity in western areas of England, but not so much in eastern areas. So more interesting kind of findings. And slide 26, one of the things that we're really keen to stress here with all our coastal research is the vast majority of people, when they're going to the coast, aren't getting wet. This isn't about people who are kayaking and windsurfing and all those kind of super active things. The vast majority of people are just going for a walk and or perhaps playing on the beach. So this is kind of your everyday physical activity stuff. It's not extreme sports. And going on to 27, another little modifier that we wanted to look at using these data was dog ownership. And we know that certainly here in the UK, dog ownership is pretty massive. We know that there are potentially some negative issues around dogs out in the natural environment and how that might impact on some people and on wildlife. But when we looked at this sort of relationship between neighbourhood green space and physical activity in this case, we found an association between how much greenery there is in your neighbourhood and how much physical activity you do, but only for dog owners. So it seems like there's one of those kind of interesting effect modifiers about what's going on for you as a person in your household and how you relate to your neighbourhood environment. So obviously we wouldn't suggest from this that everybody should go and get a dog because it will make you better, but it's an interesting thing to think about when we're trying to tease apart these complex relationships between neighbourhood environments and physical activity in this case. On the 28th, one of the really important things we can do with the MELI data is look at people who don't visit nature. And clearly, quite a large proportion of our population don't go out to even for the park at all. We've got survey data here on about 60,000 people from the MELI, and about a quarter of that population reported visiting natural environments less than once a month. So we call them infrequent visitors. And you can see there listed all the different characteristics of those kind of people who are infrequent visitors. They're more likely to be female, more likely to be in poor health, lower socioeconomic status, and so on. So there's some interesting stuff there about who isn't in the environment and who isn't accessing it. And if we skip on to slide 29, really importantly, people are asked their main reason for not visiting nature, if that's their characteristic. And you can see there some of the reasons that people give for not visiting nature. And they're the things that you might expect, like being too busy at work or being too busy at home or having poor health. And that's really important when we think about, you know, a lot of work is going on in various places now looking at interventions to promote access to the environment and promoting physical activity in the environment and all sorts of other things. And those interventions, I think, unless they take account of these kinds of specific reasons for why people aren't going out there, they're not going to work, because if they're not targeting these kinds of issues, then clearly they're kind of can be setting themselves up to fail. So really important stuff to think about who isn't visiting nature and why not. Okay, on to slide 30. I just need to mention briefly here indeed be harmful. So we do some work here around pollen and allergies, and climate change is potentially going to be really important how we're exposed to pollen in the coming years. Ticks and other disease vectors. We have a PhD student based in Public Health England who's looking at urban parks and tick exposure and Lyme disease particularly. And that's really interesting. It's not just a thing that's associated with trips out to the countryside. But other kinds of things obviously can happen through visits to nature as well. And that all situates within these wider climate change impacts. So we really need to be sort of careful not to be too evangelical and to assume that sort of natural environments really are completely benign and beneficial. And on to slide 31, as with all universal public health interventions, if we think about something like building a new park or having an educational program to promote people getting out there in the great outdoors, we potentially risk widening health inequality. And particularly, there's the potential for a risk of gentrification as we try to improve and perhaps green our urban areas, improve the quality of parks. There is this risk that comes with it, which does tend to happen, that we gentrify those areas and make them unaffordable. And there's a great group I just wanted to link there in Barcelona doing work on urban environmental justice and sustainability. And they have this whole program of work on what they call green inequalities, which is a really interesting kind of interesting area. So we've got to be careful about unintended consequences. On to 32, just to finish up my talk on informing policy and practice, there's lots of action going on at all levels in environment and health sectors, you know, from local authorities up to international kind of policy, and lots of enthusiasm, but as with all these things, money talks. So my colleague Tim Taylor is our health and environment economist based here, leading lots of different work on that, and we always tend to go and ask Tim in the end, well, okay, so what's it worth? So if we go on to 33, we wanted to ask this question, well, okay, looking specifically at that issue of physical activity in the environment, if our natural environments do support and promote physical activity, what's the health economic value of that? So we used that MIMI data to go on and ask that question. And I won't go into the detail of the methodology here, but on slide 34, we basically linked together the MIMI data with estimates of the kind of physical activity that people tend to get from different activities, and turn that into a UK social value based on the amount that NICE would pay for a treatment or intervention that produces an additional quality of about £20,000. And so relatively conservatively, we reckon that those kind of natural environment physical activity experiences are worth about £2.2 billion to public health in England alone. Clearly with relatively wide confidence intervals, but we double-checked this with an analysis using the WHO HEAT tool, if you're familiar with that, and came up with a very similar sort of number. If we go on to 35, there's clearly loads of other evidence out there. We're not the only group in the world doing this kind of stuff, and there's really been a real escalation in the last five or ten years of evidence in this area. But what does this say? On slide 36, I've just summarised the findings of a few recent systematic reviews, and they do demonstrate evidence for benefits for a range of health outcomes, but they are often limited by a lack of causal evidence, the heterogeneity of studies, both in terms of their exposure and outcome measures. They tend to be relatively limited in assessment of environmental quality, and control for socioeconomic status and other potential confounders can often be a bit limited. So, there's lots and lots of evidence out there, but it's really it's not completely robust and it's quite heterogeneous. So making sense out of it all is quite challenging at the moment. But having said that, public health policy is still getting made and environmental policy is getting made. So what's going on? On slide 37, I just wanted to go back in time a little bit and just obviously acknowledge that this is nothing new. We've been thinking about this kind of stuff in public health for a very long time. So in our Public Health Act of 1875, we go on to slide 38. The first bit there is paragraph 164, is basically that kind of Victorian public health thing of promoting the development of park and recreational grounds for the purposes of the population to take activity, basically. So that's in the Public Health Act from 1875. So really, it's been out there for a long time. And obviously, we've been thinking about nature and human existence for thousands of years prior to that. But just thinking about things that are going on at the moment, slide, we're on now, sorry, 39, we've had some interesting national policy developments. For example, here in England, the Marine Coastal Access Act from 2009, which basically mandates a coastal pass for the whole of England. Wales obviously got there before us and have already done this. I actually don't know what the situation in Scotland is with this kind of legislation, so I'd be interested to hear from anybody who knows that. But really, you know, obviously it's about other stuff around coastal access and the marine environment. But one of the key things about this is providing a recreational opportunity at the coast for the whole population around the entire coast of England. So quite an interesting bit of environmental legislation. On to the next slide. My colleague Bethan Lovell here has been doing lots of work with DEFRA, and we have various different sorts of pieces of work done with DEFRA and Natural England particularly. And Becca did a sort of fellowship for a year or two with DEFRA, developing this sort of evidence statement on the links between natural environments and human health. So a really big review of the evidence. And that kind of review that Becca led on now underpins health in the government's 25-year plan for the natural environment. So some interesting stuff there about how this actually is hopefully getting turned into relatively progressive environment policy. Just on to the next slide, 41. On a much more local level, we've done work with Cornwall Council. They were really interested in how they manage their public open space for the benefits of biodiversity, but also population health and wellbeing. This has been a project with them, thinking about how the evidence that we've got can feed into things like their open space strategy, how we might design for green space sustainability, and how we might make those connections through to local populations' health and well-being. And lastly, to sort of take a bit of a global view, this features now Sustainable Development Goals on slide 42. So SDG 11.7 promotes universal access to green and public spaces for particular population groups. And on 43, we here and various other folks have been doing work with WHO over the last few years on developing their work on urban green space in particular and how they might deal with it, how we might make those connections at a global scale between green space and health and well-being. And on slide 44, just an example, an extract of that, the kinds of things that the WHO sort of work was moving towards was stuff like relatively straightforwardly put the green space close to people and coming up with sort of some sort of rule of thumb at least about what we might expect to be reasonable to expect for population distribution of urban green space. So that's a whistle-stop tour of a lot of stuff around evidence and policy and so on. If we just wrap up on slide 45, it seems there's a rapidly growing evidence base. It has its limitations. We need to be better at considering complexity of the environment, of our interactions with it, the mechanisms and the health impacts. And I think that works really well with the current sort of public health agenda for considering complex systems. We have to accept that increasing accessibility and engagement isn't without risk. So we have to think about the potential for environmental risks of being in the great outdoors, and also the potentially negative impacts of gentrification and widening social inequalities. But sort of positive note, there does seem to be the potential at least to act to promote and protect both the natural environment and human health, and hopefully we're heading in roughly the right direction to do that. So last slide, that's all I've got. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Ben. That was great, thanks. That was a lot in that. I haven't received a single email or text asking a question, and I find that very hard to believe. Oh, here we go. Emily's got one in. Thank you, Millie. Her question is there any evidence that if you warn people of potential risks of using green space, e.g. ticks, etc., then you put them off using it?
It's a really, really good point, and it's really important. Yes, probably. It's not something that we've looked at specifically, but it's certainly something that our colleagues in Public Health England are aware of, so when we're doing this work on ticks and so on. And this is where I'd need the input of my colleague Matt White, who's an environmental psychologist, and he would frame this as being the problem around what we call the social amplification of risk framework. I think that's what it's called anyway, which tends to be the fact that we don't deal very well with risk. And so, and this is certainly the case when we think about the work that we've been doing with local authorities. I mean, we know that for very good reason, lots of local authorities and public health authorities have to be relatively careful about, you know, what's going to end up in the local paper. And this has definitely happened with ticks in various places down here. And I think, you know, we do have to be careful of not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And I think we can try and promote these positive health and well-being impacts. But I think if we don't at least nod to the risks, then we do run the risk of them kind of coming back to bite us. But it's a really, really good point, and I think we have to be really careful about trading off, you know, potentially our slightly nebulous big picture population mental health and well-being impacts versus one person who gets bitten by a tick and gets Lyme disease. It's a really, really important point.
Okay, thanks for that. Hopefully Millie's still on the line and heard that, but I should have pointed out earlier that we are actually recording all this, so you'll be able to revisit Ben's talk and the questions and answers. I've got a question here from Max Hislop. Thank you, Max. Is the SIMD a good guide to where we should focus green space budgets to improve health?
Good question. I don't really know. I think the overall indices of multiple deprivation can be a little bit misleading, and they do some fun things when you start associating them with sort of in physical environmental conditions, partly because they often contain a measure of access to services. So a distance-based metric to perhaps GP surgeries or post offices. So that can throw a real spanner in the works when we think about people living in rural environments and how much green space they live within. And those sort of nuances, I think, about area deprivation are really important to consider when we think about this. But I think it has a lot of potential, and just like we use those kinds of indices of deprivation to target other kinds of services and interventions, they definitely hold some scope to think about where might be best to go with investing money in the environment.
Thank you.
Okay, yeah, was that you, Max? I just wanted to come to you to see if there was any follow-up to that, or are you...
Yeah, well, we've been trying to grapple with that, and we've spoken to people in Health Scotland about how we might go about targeting green space investment in response to health needs, and it's provoked a lot of debate really about whether SIMD really is the right way of targeting it. But there's conflicting thoughts about it. Obviously, the health domain within SIMD is, you know, focuses on things like drug abuse and alcohol consumption and those kind of things, which is not necessarily something related to your access to green space. So the question really is, are there better indicators as to where where green space will promote good health responses? And we haven't bottomed that out yet.
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I don't think I know the answer either. And certainly, like work we've been doing recently with Public Health Dorset, we've been working with them on a green space accessibility measure, and it's nice being able to work in a very focused geographical area. There's about 750,000 people, and we've been fortunate to have a couple of researchers working on it and produce this kind of a green space accessibility measure based on a walkable network. So
we've been doing the thing that's similar work as well.
Right. Excellent. I'll be interested to hear about it. Yeah. And I think, you know, they've been finding that, you know, on a very coarse level, we relate proximity-based green space accessibility metric to IMD, actually you get a positive association. It's very, very weak, but you find better access, at least on proximity, amongst more deprived communities. Now, that's really preliminary and I think subject to all sorts of stuff. But that has been found in other studies as well. So I think these relationships are a bit complicated, and I think you're absolutely right. It sounds like you're taking the right approach to try and figure out the nuances of those relationships.
Okay. I have no other emails in, so I'll come to you all over the phone. Any points on what's just been discussed in terms of SAMD or any questions for Ben? I've just spotted one from John Redshaw. First of all, is there anyone who wants to come in on the point that was just discussed? Okay. If not, I'll go to John's question, which is, how do we best make use of this evidence in delivering Scotland's new public health priorities? What are your top three recommendations for policy and practice? And then John goes on to list the six public health priorities. I'm not sure if you'll be aware of these, Ben?
No, I don't know them actually.
Okay. There's one on having vibrant, healthy and safe places and communities for living. A Scotland where we flourish in our early years. There's one for promoting good mental well-being. One in relation to the harmful use of alcohol, tobacco and other drugs. The fifth is about a sustainable, inclusive economy with equality of outcomes for all. And then the final one is about eating well, healthy weight and physical activity. So just to remind you, the question was about what would be your top three recommendations for policy and practice.
That's a really tall order. off the top of my head.
It's John here. It's perhaps the last because I think the evidence base here has been around for some time and it's continued to evolve and be assessed in the way you've outlined, Ben. So thank you very much for that. But it's then a case of thinking that given this new focus on public health priorities in Scotland and the evidence that you've presented today seems to cut across most, if not all, of these new six public health priorities, what are we going to do differently? Where is the action going to come at the grassroots level? What are the priorities? Where will you focus your efforts? If you've got a finite budget, as we do, where do you think you could best use investments to make a difference?
It is a great question, then, and I think you're absolutely right. And I think we do now have enough evidence that it is, you know, I think it does underpin actually doing stuff and spending money. I think you're right in terms of it looks like, you know, the sorts of things that we're talking about can come across quite a lot of public health priorities. I think I'd hesitate to give a top three, but I think some critical issues that seem to be coming out are things like the first one about healthy and safe places to live. That is potentially really important, especially when we go back to that really substantial group that I was talking about people who don't visit natural environments, who don't make use of their neighbourhood parks and so on. Obviously, there's always going to be a proportion of the population that don't really care about it and would much rather go to a shopping mall, and that's absolutely fine. You know, we're not trying to tell people what they should be interested in here. But where there are opportunities, and often I think there's various bits of research that suggest that actually more socioeconomically deprived communities can have quantitatively sometimes more of these kind of public open spaces or green spaces, but they tend to be perceived as less usable, perhaps less safe, and so on. And so there's a sort of the potential for, I think, potentially relatively low-cost interventions that do something towards promoting those places and sort of making them more feel more safe, making them perceived to be health assets or community assets for the local population. And I think there has been some work done around this, certainly in urban geography, it's been going on for years with the whole thing about, you know, the broken windows sort of impact and so on, about making places that feel like they're looked after and so on. And we're starting to see that now in a couple of nice studies about improving perceptions of safety can improve use and access quite a lot. So I think there's something around that. And I think
Often these questions get seen quite in isolation. You know, how can we improve this particular bit of green space in terms of its ecology and biodiversity and stuff? And actually, we can think slightly more complex than that and think about, that thing about vibrant, healthy, safe places is a really nice way of framing it, because we can think about how the natural environment components can be really important in that, but also the other things as well that we know are really important about making those sort of healthy and perceived to be safe kind of places. And I guess early years would probably be another big one to hit on, and I don't really know exactly what the solution is on this. There's a lot of work going on around nature connectedness, and particularly in schools and education and so on, and that may have a role to play in thinking about how we sort of support and encourage kids and young people to engage with their local environments, to capitalise on the benefits of it, and to feel that kind of sense of that's my kind of space, that's somewhere I belong, as they then grow up and considering the life course. So I think that's a potentially rich kind of target. I don't know exactly that we have the evidence to prove exactly how it works, or whether or not there are really substantial things that we can do about it. I think for me, I've done quite a bit of stuff on physical activity, so I tend to come back to it, and I think I really liked that. There was a Chief Medical Officer of Health report a long while ago now that said it was, or something to do with physical activity being public health's best buy. And I think the opportunity there for activity in the outdoors, however it is, it could be in, you know, good quality built environments. But that potential is really there for relatively substantial sort of prevention at scale, public health policy. I don't know exactly how it worked best, and I think lots of the intervention studies that have been done come up struggling. So it's a difficult one, but I think potentially a rich theme to try and get into.
Yes, it does. I mean, I appreciate the complexity of the question there. And I also thank you for the presentation and for the evidence and your analysis of it. I think it is very relevant to these priorities, and it's about finding ways and using ways to actually really make a difference, because we've been wrestling with this issue of health inequalities for many years in Scotland, and that's kind of where we are with the public health reform at the moment, and it's actually starting to make good use of the evidence base to drive policy and practice and to demonstrate benefits in terms of improvements in health and reducing inequality. So thank you very much.
Okay.
Great, you're welcome.
Okay, thank you both. Would anybody else like to come in to comment or ask a question to Ben? Please do shout out, last opportunity to ask a question.
Right. It's Dermot Corby again.
Hi, Dermot.
Thank you very much for doing this. It was wonderful, and I hope you find it interesting communicating to us from darkest Cornwall. Or just in Cornwall.
Thanks very much. Yeah, you're welcome. It's really interesting, and it's some great questions and really important things to discuss, and I've definitely learned some stuff as well. I'm going to go away and look at those public health priorities, because
I think the public health priorities and how we implement them will be really quite important, and I think the sort of stuff you're talking gives more impetus to getting some sort of implementation plan together, because the new public health body is allegedly going to be doing this, I think.
Right. And as is often the case, I think down here south of the border, there's an awful lot, and we can learn both certainly from Scotland and from Wales. You know, I think that things like the Welsh wellbeing sort of legislation is pretty amazing, and I think there's a lot to learn. So that's great.
Mm-hmm. Lots of coastline in Northern Ireland as well as the border.
Yeah.
You may have heard about.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay, I have received a question from Joanna Chutin. So, what have the implications of the evidence statement on the links between natural environment and health for DEFRA at a policy and practical level? Oh, sorry, policy and practice level. So, what are the
implications? The implications of it, hopefully, are that it actually features relatively strongly in the 25-year plan for the environment. I think previous to this, when we first started talking to DEFRA a few years ago, they weren't entirely sure what to do with it, and sort of not entirely sure what the state of the evidence was and what we really knew. So I think through the process of working collaboratively on that, hopefully it's kind of, and I think it's not just through this work that we've done with them, it is kind of, this stuff is out there in the ether as well, lots of other people doing similar work on it in different places, and I think it's that's helped to sort of support the fact that this can be an important thread of the 25-year plan for the environment. And indeed, there is now, you know, DEFRA are now funding quite a few programs and things off the back of the 25-year plan that will relate to health and well-being. So hopefully it is actually turning into some relatively good sort of actual policy and practice action.
Okay, thanks. Joanna, do you want to comment?
Yeah, I was just interested because we're doing some work with the Scottish Government at the moment around co-benefits, around some of the climate change adaptation mitigation strategies, and it's just interesting to see, you know, how evidence statements on the links between natural environment and health at a sort of national policy level, what your experience of them in terms of playing out in terms of actual influencing policy and practice and funding opportunities for interventions that benefit both sustainability and health outcomes.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it is really important. And I think obviously for us, we're really keen to make sure that the research that we do actually does have that real sort of meaningful role to play. But also, I guess we're sort of very conscious that policy is set on the basis of all sorts of other stuff as well. And so this is just a small part of the picture, but hopefully it sort of at least gives, you know, in this case, an environment minister, the confidence to say, actually, this is a reasonable thing to include, and it's not just sort of more wacky environmentalist kind of stuff. There is actually some reasonable evidence to underpin it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Well, that's nearly 1:30, so I'd just like to bring this session to a close. Thank you, Ben, once again, for a really interesting presentation. Just to let everybody know that the slides will be available on the Scotland website, and we'll circulate the link as well as the recording. So if you want to revisit any of it, please do so, and feel free to disseminate to colleagues. So Ben, thank you very much for your time and your presentation, and I hope you've taken something from it as well through the questions.
Absolutely, thanks. I really enjoyed it and great discussion, so thanks. And like I said, I'm always happy to have emails of people and have chats following things up. That's great,
that's good to know. Okay, so well, thank you everybody.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.